buying power, on the colonial power. And in that case, that was what caused them to back off. So these kind of black and white kind of viewpoints that we have on violence and nonviolence, they just don't work in anti-colonial struggle. Sometimes nonviolent struggle will work. Sometimes it won't. Sometimes violent struggle will not work. Sometimes it will work. And once again, colonized people have the absolute right to do what is necessary to resist against colonization. You know, that's the case all around the world. That's the case when it goes to the indigenous people in Canada. I mean, they used armed self-defense in the Oka crisis and in various other cases as well when they felt it was necessary. And sometimes it was effective for them. Sometimes it was necessary for, like, Mohawk warriors to go out with guns in their hands and stand up to the cops and to the Canadian Army in the case of the Oka crisis. You know, sometimes this is necessary. You know, it shouldn't be glamorized or anything like that, but it is sometimes necessary for colonized people to fight back like that. And that has to be understood. It's something that people in the West really have a problem understanding in a lot of ways, largely because of the media they consume and the way the media demonizes that kind of resistance. But one of the anti-colonial struggles that me and others have really talked about a lot on this show is the Black liberation struggle in America. And me and Brendan Campisi in particular have spoken a lot about the role that international solidarity played in that movement and how groups like the Black Panthers were genuinely inspired by the many anti-colonial struggles happening around the world in the 1960s and 70s, including the Palestinian struggle, as well as by revolutionary governments that had emerged out of the anti-colonial struggles, of which there were many, you know, such as Cuba, China, Vietnam, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Algeria, and many others. There was a real anti-colonial solidarity in these movements that transcended frontiers and was truly internationalist in form and content. And this is the international movement against colonialism that is, for the most part, missing from today's world. And given how interconnected these struggles are, these anti-colonial struggles around the world are, and how global the impact of imperialism and capitalist exploitation are, it is essential that a new movement be created that is international and can fight against colonialism. You know, this is essential, I would say, right now. And I want to share with you before I get into the next piece, which is going to be, I'll describe what the next piece is going to be. Eddie Conway of the Black Panther Party recently spoke on The Real News about how he and his comrades were affected by the Chinese Revolution, in particular in the 1960s. You know, as part of the Black Panthers being very internationalist in orientation and showing solidarity with anti-colonial struggles around the world, which, you know, the Chinese government was engaged in at that time. They were engaged in solidarity work with the anti-colonial struggles around the world, as the Soviet Union was. But what I want to read to you is a poem which I did, which I entirely forgot about. I did this poem back in 2010, in December 2010. And this poem is entitled Lenin. It's Lenin. You know, I was inspired to write this by, you know, Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, great Russian revolutionary, you know, and such an iconic figure in the international revolutionary struggle throughout the 20th century. And I rediscovered this poem that I wrote years ago, you know, 8 years ago now almost. And basically, I think it captures something about the role that he had. At least I hope it captures some of the role that he had in inspiring anti-colonial struggle around the world, which he did. Like, through his example and the example of the Russian revolutionary movement, they inspired, they reinforced, they assisted so many anti-colonial struggles, you know, against the British Empire, the French Empire, against the Dutch Empire, all these different empires around the world that existed at that time. The Soviet Union was a rallying point for resistance against those empires. And the figure of Lenin as a symbol was very much an anti-colonial symbol. The same way that Che Guevara would become an anti-colonial symbol in the 1960s, you know. Lenin was seen in that way around the world, you know, and he was an inspiration for so many people fighting against colonialism, you know, as well as against capitalism. And of course, these things go hand in hand. So the poem itself goes like this. Good intentions are not enough. What do you do when the world around you is twisted and tainted? When the most hellish injustice passes before your wandering eyes? nourishment for the beast whose hunger has no end. Beggars, thieves, filthy factory barracks. 3-year-olds whose only toys are the lethal cogs and spinning wheels of iron machines. Whose waking nightmare dreams carry them across the deadly jungle of the factory floor and into the cracks and crevices that mark the haggard, guilt-ridden, broken faces of their mothers. Innocence is no defense against the hounds of hell, and cold streets swallow the prisoners of the night, child prostitutes who sell their bodies to the unwashed crowds, draining the excess lust of an oppressed people until its irrepressible raging consumes their flesh, snaps their bones, and leaves them done to death in a broken stairwell or a dirty back alley. Their bodies, limbs, the organic tools of life itself, fuel for the city's medical schools as they teach their students how to save the arms and legs of those who can afford the cost of living. What do you say to cold eyes, lonely eyes, angry eyes, sad eyes, dead eyes? What is left for you to be? For once you know, you can never go back. From the Moskva to the Neva, rivers flow black with the tears of the condemned. The ghosts of reality will never leave you alone, plunging at you in your sleep and gnawing at the edges of your dreams. Tranquil boyhood homes transformed into citadels of lies, beautiful green fields, rushing streams and warm breezes screaming with the desperate cruelty of distended bellies gorged on clay. What is left? Trapped in darkness, trapped in hell, except to be the vanguard of the new dawn, the light to the hopeless, a living symbol of who they can be, a living hammer breaking living chains. What is left but to be a light, a spark? What is left in a world where 99.9% of politicians are servitors of a criminal system, except to have the courage to stand among the 0.01% who call themselves revolutionaries? To stand amongst those who have cast themselves into the fire, crossed the threshold into endless struggle, sacrificed privilege and comfort in the name of a dream they may never see fulfilled. To throw oneself in terror into the unknown, navigating storm-tossed seas in search of new lands, just barely visible on the far horizon and shrouded by enough reefs and shoals to make any sane man turn back in fear. But the revolutionary leader is no martyr. No willing sacrifice upon that bloody political altar that eternally thirsts for the blood of the ambitious. No, he is there to win. An elder brother swinging from the hangman's noose. A grieving mother. A naive bunch of idealists, a broken tribe of assassins. A shattered, lonely Parisian commune that never had a chance. Spanish anarchists ground into dust because they refused to stand together against a pathetic, ill-disciplined government army that could barely crawl, let alone walk. This time, we'll walk a different way. No, he is not here to play the martyr. For there is only one thing that the living can do for the dead. One thing that can soothe the pain of those alive but barely living. Those standing yet barely walking, those working yet barely surviving, those broken yet yearning to be whole again. One thing, and that is to win and to keep winning. To form up lines and never break them. To achieve the unthinkable because the organization is unshakable. So when you ask, why won't he let you give a dissenting opinion? He will respond that your dissenting opinion means more dead children, more tiny hands shackled, more tiny hearts with no love, and more tiny brains uneducated. Why does he dislike debate? Because there is no time. Why is he so hard? Because enough is enough. Why is he so damn authoritarian? Because We can't, because without discipline, we lose. And losers don't make revolutions. There's only one way out of hell. We can't afford to be innocent, and we can't afford to play nice when our only playmates are devils and fiends. Words mean nothing without action. The greatest of warriors are born with the taste of injustice on their tongues, and in a shackled land, Russian Simbirsk has spawned a Spartacus. But he knows in his righteous might that he is nothing but a symbol, an inspiration, an organizer. For the people make revolution just as gods are made through the looking glass of oppressed eyes burning with a secret power, a strength that was never thought possible amid the rubble of crushed dreams. But now the impossible has become reality. A thousand vast hopes painted on a field of red. Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, born anew. A revolutionary in full flower. A life runs over with hopes, fears, exile, and return. Sparks fly, and finally fire sweeps the land as 100 million hearts burst into flame. It is 1917, and the spring wind sweeps away the dust of winter beneath an April sun. And the world hears a cry, 50 years in the making. The streets rebound to marching feet, the creaking of open gates and the beckoning of a million hands as dark clouds begin to break upon the anvil of history. Statues and old gods shatter as the child looks up from the oppressive spinning of the power loom to the sound of distant thunder, rebounding from pavements watered in blood and the voices of arisen people. 10 days that shook the world. New words rise with the dawn and echo through time and space. My name is Vladimir. I am the revolutionary, and I am here to win. The impossible has become reality. A thousand vast hopes painted on a field of red. In autumn's ashes, a new man, a new world, is born. And bright eyes stare into the future that stretches on endlessly. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Welcome to The Real News. I'm Eddie Conway, coming to you from Baltimore. Recently, I have been looking at the relationship between African Americans and the Chinese, and the relationship between China and the nations of the African continent. So joining me today to give us an overview of that relationship is Dr. Robeson Frazier. He's an associate professor at Amherst School of Communications and Journalism at the University of Southern California. He is also the author of The East is Black, Cold War China, and the Black Radical Imagination, which explores Black American political relationship with Communist China during the Cold War. Professor Frazier, thanks for joining me.
Oh, it's a pleasure to join you today.
Also, the spread of Chairman Mao's Red Book seemed to have played a key role in our development and organizing, and it looks like it was also involved in the liberation movements in Africa as well as in South America. What happened with that? Is that Red Book still important today? What's the outcome of that?
So That's a great and fascinating question. I mean, actually, to also refer to your previous question, when you were talking about and mentioning Robert Franklin Williams, he and his partner, Mabel Williams, you know, another extremely important black radical activist, thinker, internationalist, both of them. You know, I think, well, the circulation even of Mao's red book, you know, Robert Franklin Williams, you know, is a central, he and Mabel Williams are a central factor too in, you know, the red book's ability to travel and take on a certain kind of political, cultural capital, you know, in places beyond China throughout the 1960s and 70s. So, you know, from my studies, you know, when people like, you know, the young men and women who established the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, the young black men and women who established organizations like the Revolutionary Action Movement, the Congress of African People, like, you know, the works, you know, one of the works that they're reading, you know, are the writings, the ideologies, the arguments of Mao Zedong. And so it's particularly interesting how, you know, his positions about protracted struggle, you know, about revolutionary praxis, you know, about tactical alliances, about united fronts, how that takes on a certain kind of currency and value in places, you know, and in political context beyond that of China throughout this period you're referring to. And I think today, while the book maybe doesn't have, you know, and those works don't have the same amount of currency, you know, at least within the U.S., I mean, I still find, you know, in my relationships and conversations with organizers, activists who are part of radical organizations, they too, you know, reading Mao's works and trying to figure out and center how these ideas might be applied within the specific, you know, national, local context of their own work. So it's interesting, you know, that this book, you know, which really becomes, you know, like, especially after it's translated in the late 1960s, I mean, you know, people, I mean, I talked to my uncles, you know, who referred to the ways that it just took on a certain kind of power and currency and capital, you know, in terms of, you know, being able to juxtapose different kinds of political beliefs and outlooks, you know, in Harlem, in Baltimore, in Philadelphia in the late 60s and 70s. But even today, as I said, like how people are still pulling from it.
Okay, well, let's leap forward a minute because I'm concerned with the relationship now of China and the continent, the African nations. Can you, do you have any kind of opinion of what's happening over there now in terms of the relationship and interaction between Black Africans or, well, Africans in the diaspora in particular, and Chinese expansion into Africa?
Well, number one, I think it's, you're seeing different kinds of developments in different countries, you know, so China is more heavily involved and active in specific countries, but I do think we're seeing right now a serious kind of prioritization among the Chinese government, among Chinese corporations, and really expanding their economic footprint within the continent. You know, as you and I were talking about before, in terms of, you know, like providing resources, money for infrastructure development, you know, working to expand the footprint of different kinds of Chinese technological devices, cell phones, you know, within various African countries' kind of national marketplaces. I mean, we're also seeing it from the other side in terms of China's efforts to, you know, gain access to various African natural resources. I mean, you know, simply the kind of, you know, minerals that are utilized within our cell phones, you know, so I think there's a serious kind of a investment, you know, by the Chinese state and corporations in Africa. And that's really kind of that isn't new. I mean, China has been really prioritizing Africa since the 1960s. You know, we can go back to the Trans-Am Railway. And, you know, one of the benefits, at least early on, of China's efforts in Africa was that China was willing to provide, you know, interest-free loans. You know, so for many African nations, they looked at the Chinese as, you know, an important alternative to that of, you know, the IMF or the World Bank or, you know, the kind of U.S. model of globalism, which is really, you know, neo-colonialism, neo-imperialism, you know. But I do think kind of that what we're seeing in China right now, I don't know. You know, some folks actually refer to it as kind of like China's own neo-colonial project in Africa. And it's clear the relationship is extremely uneven. The relationship is extremely leaned towards China's own interests, China's ability to dump surplus goods, you know, in African countries, China's ability to, you know, they're dealing with serious labor issues. So they're able to reposition workers, Chinese workers, in Africa to, you know, build roads and build stadiums that no one ever uses, you know, build hospitals that at times, you know, the hospital's built, but there's been no development of human skills where, you know, there can be doctors, African-based doctors to actually work in those hospitals. So the relationship is extremely uneven, but I do think what we're witnessing there is something also unique and distinctive, and we're still trying to cultivate the right kind of language and frameworks to make sense of it.
Okay, I was in Africa a couple of years ago and had the opportunity to come in close proximity to a lot of Chinese workers as well as some of their cultural events. And it felt to me that they were standoffish. Is this something about their cultural, historical cultural behavior, or is there a distance now between the Chinese workers that's in Africa as opposed to how the Chinese were operating in Africa in the 60s and the 70s, or when they were interacting with the young nations that were being liberated and supported?
Well, I definitely think there's a difference. I mean, one of the clear differences, you know, at least in the 60s, it was represented and framed through the notion of, you know, revolutionary solidarity, you know, solidarity for the sake of upending, you know, colonial and imperial relations, you know. And the Chinese were also pretty active in, you know, showcasing this kind of solidarity, not just through, you know, economic military support, but also, you know, through cross-cultural exchange. So, and I'll say this, it was oftentimes more lean towards, you know, Africans coming to China, for instance, to study, you know, and receive bachelor's degrees and master's and professional degrees in particular kinds of subjects. So it was more lean towards, you know, Africans going to China as opposed to Chinese going to Africa to engage and delve into African, you know, African, the cultures of different African countries and nations, you know. But nonetheless, it was still oriented around a kind of sense of sharing of culture and the role that culture could play in fostering political alliance solidarity. I think today, I mean, as you described, you know, I think what we're seeing more of is, you know, Chinese companies, for instance, kind of coming into African countries and really, you know, kind of sequestering, segregating their workers. You know, I mean, like they basically, I mean, I'm sure you probably saw this, they build these kind of compounds where their workers kind of operate. And to some degree, it's almost as if it's their own kind of like mini version of China within, you know, Angola or Tanzania or one of these, you know. And as a result, you know, that prevents any kind of sharing of culture, you know, any kind of communication about difference. And you're right. As a result, these relations are far more economic than cross-cultural But I think that's one version of it, because I do think there are there also are you know, Chinese entrepreneurs who've moved to various African countries and that's become their home, you know. So there are also, you know, Chinese kind of enclaves in various countries, and you know, we've seen and it's more so Chinese men who are marrying African women, you know, and having mixed race children. But it's interesting to see this kind of development where the Chinese men are kind of becoming part of, you know, African communities. And I'm interested to see there, like, you know, what their lives are like, what their wives' lives are like, you know, what are their children's lives like, and how is this producing different kinds of Chinese-Africa relations that oftentimes don't get highlighted, for instance, you know, in news media, you know, that oftentimes it's either framed through the kind of lens of, you know, the U.S. saying the Chinese are over there kind of fostering neocolonialism and imperialism in Africa, or it's from the Chinese kind of state narrative of, look at all that we're doing there, you know, look at our look how fruitful these relations with China are. And I'm far more interested in the kind of in the gray, you know, where we can recognize that this is an extremely uneven set of relations, but at the community level, there's far more complexity in terms of actually what's transpiring.
Okay, Dr. Frazier, thanks for giving us an update on the past relationships and the present relationships between China and Africans and Africa Americans. Thanks for doing that for us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Okay. And thank you for joining The Real News.
listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was a song of the Chinese Revolution right there. The East is Red is what that song is called. And what we heard before that was, of course, was Eddie Conway talking about the role of the Chinese revolutionary ideology, what Chinese Revolution, what the anti-colonial struggle in China, really the way it inspired, the way it worked to inspire anti-colonial struggles around the world, including the Black Panthers in the United States, you know, who, of course, were reading Chairman Mao's Little Red Book. They were inspired by certain aspects of the Chinese resistance to colonialism and the revolutionary movement in China. And of course, me and Brendan Campisi talked about these things when we talked about the Black Panther Party a few years ago. So I think it's actually worth playing that clip again, the clip where Brendan and me actually talk about the Black Panther Party and its role in this constellation of anti-colonial struggles going on around the world in the 1960s and 1970s, and how it built relationships with movements around the world fighting for the self-determination of peoples and for revolutionary change. And this was really one of the great strengths of the Black Panther Party was its internationalism. And so this is what, so I think that's definitely worth playing again. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. So basically, well, yeah, like let's get in a little bit on the international connections
sure.
that the Black Panther Party's had. Because, I mean, you said it was in Cuba, it was in Algeria. I know Huey Newton went to China at one point, you know, and North Korea, there was even a connection
yeah.
there. So maybe you could get into elaborating on some of that.
Sure. Well, again, this is what I would describe as another area where Malcolm X articulated an idea and then the Panthers tried to put it into practice. And so there's this idea floating around in the African-American movement and in the radical movements of the time of third world internationalism, that all the colonized and oppressed peoples of the world should, you know, should unite and were uniting against global white supremacy and imperialism. And the Black Panthers carried that out, and they established political connections with anti-imperialist regimes and increasingly with socialist countries in the third world. So yes, they did go to China. Members of the Black Panther Party went to China. They established connections with China. And Huey Newton came back from China absolutely thrilled with what he had seen. This was around 1970, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely thrilled with what he had seen. And the things that he said about China echoed what an earlier generation of African-American revolutionaries had said about the USSR in the 1930s and 40s and 50s, which is that he said that when he went to China, he felt like a human being. That he felt like a human being in a profound way that white racist society in the United States had never for a moment allowed him to feel, which is a lot like what Paul Robeson and Langston Hughes said about the Soviet Union when they went. So there's the Chinese connection there. And the Panthers also promoted, to an extent, the image and the ideas of Mao Zedong. And they it started just with the Panthers making a bit of money by selling copies of the Little Red Book to white leftists. That was the birth of the connection. But Mao did, and eventually the leadership took up Mao as an intellectual influence. And they started using Mao in political education in the party. Fred Hampton in Chicago was a sort of one of the more communist-oriented Panthers, and he made sure that Mao was used in their political education program in the Chicago branch. So there's the Chinese connection. They also had a connection with Cuba. Members of the party went to Cuba for diplomatic reasons. They met representatives of North Vietnam and the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam in Cuba. And they also, some Panthers and other black revolutionaries at the time, also went into exile in Cuba. And they also, again, established a connection with Vietnam, as I just mentioned. I can't remember who it was, but one of the leaders of the party suggested to the North Vietnamese that they send a black international brigade, effectively, to fight the U.S. Army alongside the Vietnamese. And that was politely rejected. But the North Vietnamese government and the liberation forces in South Vietnam were very, very appreciative of all the efforts that the Black Panther Party went to promote solidarity with the Vietnamese struggle in the United States, which they did a lot of work on that. And and Algeria, as I mentioned, some Panthers went into exile in Algeria. And Algeria was a country that a lot of people on the radical left in the world and a lot of people involved in national liberation struggles had a lot of hope for at this point in history. Algeria, of course, had become independent in 1962 at the end of a very long, extraordinarily hard-fought struggle for independence against the French.
Mm-hmm.
And the political posture that the new leadership in Algeria, in independent Algeria, struck in the 1960s and 70s was one of militant anti-imperialism and solidarity with all national liberation movements in the world that were still fighting their own struggles. Algeria provided support to liberation struggles in sub-Saharan Africa that were still going on, struggles in the Arab world, including and especially the Palestinian struggle, and they also established this connection with the African-American movement. And for a time, Algeria did not have diplomatic relations with the government of the United States, but they did have diplomatic relations to the point of there being an embassy in Algiers with the Black Panther Party. So the Black Panther Party effectively, as far as the Algerian government was concerned, was kind of the government of exile of America. And certain members of the leadership of the party did speak of the Panthers as a government in exile, at least for Black America and possibly for all of America at times. There's a clip in the Black Power mixtape where Eldridge Cleaver, in exile in Algeria, effectively expresses that idea. And that can sound a bit grandiose, but when you think about it concretely, they had more of a claim to being legitimate representatives of the African American population than the white racist American state does. So there was a bit of
it's true.
There was a bit of substance to that, even if there was also rhetoric in it as well. And yes, they also did establish a connection with North Korea. And I don't know too much about the details of that, but I do know. I've seen a copy of a cover of the Black Panther newspaper with Kim Il Sung's image on it. So to an extent, they did the same thing that they did with Mao, in that they saw him as they saw Kim Il Sung, they saw the Korean Revolution as an example of a colonized country that had fought and liberated itself from imperialism, and especially as the Panthers became more oriented towards socialism, they became more influenced by socialist countries, but it was mostly specifically socialist countries of the third world, like Vietnam, Cuba, Korea, and China.
Mm. Yeah, and so these are, of course, the countries that are standing in solidarity with the Panthers in their struggle, and, of course, they've developed these kind of international connections. It's really quite extraordinary, like, how in-depth some of these connections became. But even in the United States, you could say there was kind of some almost, you could say, internationalist kind of connections in terms of them influencing other organizations, say, like in, like, Hispanic groups that are fighting for, fighting against injustice, perpetrated by the state against their own communities, and even white organizations that you could say are, like, standing up to the to the state in America.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you could mention some of those. This is a history that not many people know about, right?
That's true, and that's unfortunate. This is probably one of the most important, I would say, one of the most important aspects of the impact that the Black Panther Party had. And it is correct to say internationalism, at least in terms of the understanding that they would have had of the situation at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, as you mentioned, there were organizations inspired by the Black Panther Party in a variety of different communities. This is something that basically starts happening in 1968, I would say. And a good place to start looking at it is in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
with the influence of Fred Hampton as an individual. It sounds like we're talking about Fred Hampton a lot, but he was really, really extraordinary.
Well,
so
yeah,
we're going to.
It's true.
So Fred Hampton, one of the aspects of the Panthers' work in Chicago was politicizing street gangs.
Right.
And at first that was black street gangs. And the Panthers were successful in some areas in doing that, in showing the young black men who were in these gangs that the reason that they were in the situation that they were in and that they had to turn to the path that they had in their lives was because of capitalism and white supremacy. And they were able to start politicizing these people. And that had an impact in Chicago's Puerto Rican community, where a man named Jose Jimenez was influenced by Hampton to do the same thing with the gang that he led. And that created an organization called the Young Lords. And the Young Lords took up the kind of community service, serve the people programs that the Black Panthers were running in the black community in Chicago and in cities across the United States. Haven't really been talking about that, but you know, it's an important aspect of the Black Panthers and what they did. And so Jimenez and the Young Lords took that up in the Puerto Rican community. There have been large Puerto Rican communities formed in the United States from the late 1940s, in the continental United States from the late 1940s onward, with sort of the collapse of the agricultural economy in Puerto Rico. People had no choice but to move to the mainland, to the colonizing country, in order to make a living. And large communities develop in New York especially, but also in other cities in the Northeast and the Great Lakes. And the Young Lords as an organization begin to spread into those other communities. They start in Chicago, but then Puerto Rican student activists in New York, who are in Chicago for a meeting of Students for a Democratic Society, learn about the Young Lords. And they realize that they can take radical politics off campus and into the Puerto Rican community. And circles of politicized and radicalized Puerto Rican youth start to develop in New York, and they come together to create another Young Lords organization, which then spreads to Boston and New Jersey and a number of large Puerto Rican communities on the East Coast. And they took up the kind of politics that the Panthers did, which was to start from the basic material needs of the community. And the basic material needs of the community and the basic material situation of the community was very, very similar to that of the African-American population. You had mass unemployment and low-wage work, crowded, unhealthy housing, poor health conditions, you know, hospitals that didn't really serve the people, especially for the Puerto Rican community. It was very, very difficult for people to get health care in Spanish, especially you know, even in New York, where there were millions of Spanish-speaking people, and police brutality and murder of Puerto Rican youth, that was also a problem. So the Young Lords did things like in New York, they organized, because garbage wasn't being picked up in the Puerto Rican community, they organized a mass gathering of garbage and then burned it in the center of the street and created a barricade. And they forced the city through that to start picking up garbage. And they started organizing along with a coalition of other organizations, most of which I think I'll get the opportunity to talk about, for a new hospital to be built on the Lower East Side in the poorest area, or one of the poorest areas in New York, that would serve the interests of the people, where people would be able to get quality medical service, decent working conditions for medical workers, service in their native languages for Spanish and Chinese-speaking immigrants. So the Young Lords are a very, very good example of an organization that was influenced by the Panthers, both in terms of directly where they came from and in terms of trying to take up the same kind of politics to deal with the issues that existed for their people. And organizations like this developed in every racially or nationally oppressed community in the United States. In the Southwest, you have Chicano youth creating organizations like the Brown Berets, that attempted to do the same thing. Again, in a remarkably similar situation, of course, you have the Chicano people suffering horrific national oppression for 150 years since the occupation of the Southwest by the United States, and the same kind of politics is taken up. And in the Asian American community, where many of the issues are similar, but there are also some differences. Incidentally, this is when Asian American is actually coined as a term. It was created
at this time.
It was created to create political unity between Chinese and Japanese and Filipino Americans, basically, and the other East and South Asian communities that existed in the United States, and to replace the racist term Oriental. But in any case, in New York, Chinese American youth created an organization called Ai Wur Kwen, which was named after a revolutionary nationalist organization in China in the early 20th century, and that, again, tried to take revolutionary politics to the Chinese community, to New York's Chinatown, where people were struggling over housing. Many established Asian communities in the United States were being displaced at this point by urban development. So there was a struggle for people to be able to stay in their homes and for real redevelopment in those communities that wouldn't drive people out but would actually give people jobs and enable people to stay where they were living in a coherent sort of ethnic cultural community where people wanted to live. So that was one of the fronts of struggle for the Asian organizations that took this up. There was another organization of Chinese and Japanese American youth in San Francisco called the Red Guard Party that was, as you can probably tell by its name, also influenced by China, as was Aiwer Quen in New York. They were influenced by the Chinese Revolution and the Cultural Revolution going on in China. But they were also very, very immediately influenced by the Black Panthers. And again, it's a very, very similar story in that they took up the demands and the needs of their people in this very, very immediate way, but tried to relate revolutionary politics to those things. And of course, being in San Francisco, they had a very, very close, materially close relationship with the central leadership of the Black Panther Party in Oakland. And there was another organization, a Latino organization, which I would call it that because it wasn't just member. They weren't just Puerto Rican. They weren't just Chicano. There were Puerto Ricans and Chicanos and Central American immigrants involved, called the Los Siete organization, and that developed out of a situation where a group of Latino activists, young Latino activists, seven of them, were being framed for the murder of a couple of police officers, and an organization developed that was originally basically just the Los Siete Defense Campaign. But then developed into a wider organization to serve the impoverished and oppressed Latino community in a neighborhood called the Mission District in San Francisco. And they established ties with the Red Guard Party and with the Black Panthers in Oakland. And this was definitely conceived of as internationalism because, again, the ideological framework that these people were adopting at this time, the young activists were adopting at this time, was based on a firm rejection of the idea that their communities were minorities in American society, that they were American minorities, Mexican Americans or what have you, and based on an understanding of their communities as nations, as colonized, oppressed nations within the United States. It was slightly different with the Asian American communities, who had a somewhat different historical experience in terms of immigration, but in general, They all saw themselves as being intimately connected to the surge of third world national liberation struggles and of having a deep, deep commonality of interest in overturning white supremacist capitalism in the United States. And the American Indian movement also developed in the same time among initially young Native Americans in the cities in the Midwest, but also spreading across the country. And their ideology was had a different, to some extent, a different set of influences, influenced by sort of a revival of indigenous traditionalism in a lot of ways. But they also did echo the third world internationalist ideology of the Black Panthers that was being put forward by the Black Panthers and these other organizations to an extent. So again, there are variations dealing with the specific histories and deriving from the specific histories of all of these oppressed people, but ultimately they were united by a common framework that the Panthers had developed and popularized, and that might not seem so remarkable. It is, but it might not seem that way given that all of these groups of people suffer from racial oppression in North American society. But then there was another set of organizations that was influenced by the Black Panther Party that, as you said, many people are surprised to learn ever existed because they were organizations made up of white people. And I've already mentioned one group of white people that was influenced by the Black Panther Party, and that was Students for a Democratic Society. But Students for a Democratic Society had a particular demographics, a particular social character, in that it was made up of university students, and it was made up in the majority of young white people from middle-class backgrounds. Working-class people were going to university in the United States in larger numbers than they ever had before at this time, but at least the founders and the people who set the character of SDS were mostly middle-class people. But towards the end of the 1960s, some young white activists who were from working class backgrounds began to wonder if they wouldn't be able to organize in their own communities. And this was also a demand that was being put to them by the black movement. Mm-hmm. Not so much specifically by the Black Panther Party, although the Black Panther Party did play a role in it. But one important development that happened in the late 1960s was that the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which had been the main organization of black youth in the United States in the early 1960s, took a nationalist turn. People like Stokely Carmichael became more and more influenced by African nationalism, by Pan-Africanism. And a decision was made that white activists would no longer be allowed to work in the organization. And they were told to go organize their own people. And most of the white activists who were involved, some of them were, you know, they were hurt, but they accepted the political rationale. They accepted, you know, the fact that they needed to take direction from the black movement on this. And they did start to take up the task of organizing their communities. Of course, one of the features of this situation is that the situation in North America in the late 1960s is that there's a real climate of militancy and mass mobilization among people of color, especially the black community, but not just the black community, in all these other repressed nationality communities that we've been talking about. But there was much less of that going on among the broad majority of white Americans outside of the campus environment. But there was a very significant effort made to change that. And so you have organizations sprouting up in white working class communities in Brooklyn, in Chicago, in Philadelphia, in Boston, in Vancouver. There was an organization in Vancouver that tried to carry out the politics of the Black Panther style sort of community organizing. It was called the Partisan Party. And some of these organizations, it's funny, they had names that you would not imagine a leftist organization having. There was an organization in Brooklyn called White Lightning, which sounds like a racist organization, but it was a militant anti-racist organization that was taking up this task of organizing white people. And that meant two things. That meant attempting to convince poor and working-class white Americans that they should support the black liberation movement. But it also meant organizing these communities around their own needs. And there were particular situations that were sort of very, very close in some ways to the situation that had produced the Black Panther Party. In the 1940s and 50s and 60s, there was a huge migration of poor white people from Appalachia into the industrial sort of Northwest and Great Lakes area. And they ended up concentrated together in communities with high unemployment and low incomes and terrible housing, and young people in those communities were dealing with police harassment as well. So there was an organization that developed in this Appalachian community in Chicago called the Young Patriots. Again, Fred Hampton. Fred Hampton was able to create an alliance between the Black Panthers, the Young Patriots, the Young Lords. I believe there may have been a Chinese organization in Chicago involved as well, a Chinese-American organization. And this was called the Rainbow Coalition, which, of course, would be sort of the name 20 or so years later, adopted by the Jesse Jackson campaign in a very, very different set of political circumstances. But this was the first Rainbow Coalition, and it's probably the clearest example of the internal internationalism, you could say, of the Black Panther Party. And I think Fred Hampton expressed this most articulately and most clearly, but it came from all the major leaders of the Black Panther Party, was that they really deeply believed that they were not simply participating in and dealing with a struggle of black people against racist oppression. What they were dealing with was a struggle of all oppressed and colonized nations and all oppressed and exploited people in North America, in the United States, in North America, and in the world against a system defined by racism but also by capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And so they believe that even if even if at first, you know, many white workers were hesitant, or poor white people were hesitant to support the Black Liberation Movement, that ultimately, ultimately this alliance could be created because all oppressed and exploited people had had common interests. And that's also one of the sort of one of the crucial contributions that the Black Panther Party made.
Mm-hmm. And of course, this is something we are definitely not told about. I mean, the idea that the white supporters of the Black Panther Party, who actually made a real effort,
yeah,
like organizing effort in their own communities to organize, like, effectively white people against the very colonial structure, racist colonial structure, yeah, that had, you know, supposedly empowered them, but at the same time, you know, supposedly elevated them over African Americans and like indigenous people and this sort of thing, but basically were also using them and exploiting them and basically treating them as, you know, weapons to be used, tools, mm-hmm, you know, basically being used and turning them almost into little monsters, which they effectively were refusing to be a part of, which is pretty profound. I think that has lessons for us right now.
Absolutely. You know?
But thank you very much for coming on and talking to us about this, because I mean, this is absolutely, this conversation has been amazing.
It's my pleasure.
You know, your insight into this, like, you brought a lot of knowledge here, and I'm amazed you managed to remember all that. I mean, that was, I mean, you can't see this, people who are actually listening in, but Brendan is sitting here, he has no notes in front of him, he's basically just, you know, you did a lot of preparation, obviously.
I tried.
But at the same time, like, you're, you know, this is all coming from your head, right? This is just communicating, which is absolutely amazing. So, once again, comrade, I want to thank you again for contributing here on this show.
Thanks
and
a lot. It's great
this
to
here.
Always great to be here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're going to take a short break here. I'm back in the USSR, and we're going to be back after a few minutes. So please stay tuned.
So read the Communist Manifesto, gorillas in the mix, the Guevara and Manesto. So
what a brother with an afro now.
Yo, go a flow for the Mac, and we the hoes, so grow, cause the Lucian brothers might get hung. Rhetoric flowing from the tip of my mouth, say tongue deficit.
Money spent,
that's the glint.
Oh my not, as the cut welfare, 25%.
And I dissent as I clinch and raise my
we
fist.
We did away with that.
So you could get with this, it's a twist, cause we'll overthrow like Kwame Nkrumah. Spread around the world as if it were a business rumor. Bam, cuts a record like a surgeon cuts a tumor from a brain.
We're all cooped up, so feel the pain.
From 400 years of exploitation, anesthesia provided by your local TV station. Patience is not a virtue.
I ain't waiting.
Turn this shit over like Bush did a boatload of hate.
Geronimo, you jack a prick.
Liberty, liberty.